If you don't have a handout yet, raise your hand, and Sam's got a few over there, and I've got a few more up here if we run out. I think they have them over there. There's some back here. See, it serves to get in here, serves your purpose to get in here and get your seat early so you'll get a handout. If you come in late, you might not get one, I guess. All right, welcome to the class. We're talking about Jesus as a rabbi in the Gospels. And in the book of John, he's called rabbi more often than he is in the others, but he's also called that in Matthew and in Luke as well. What does rabbi mean? Teacher. And that first verse we looked at in John where they put in parenthesis when rabbi was first used, which means teacher. And of course, Jesus was the great teacher. But there are certain things about being a rabbi that we don't understand in the Western world. We call them professors or something, and so we don't have the religious overtones that the rabbi was immersed in. So in the Western, we talked about that in the early chapters. We might just review for just a few minutes here. In the early part of this story, we talked about the fact that we're trying to think like the Jews thought and use their terms and their viewpoints because we tend to think like Westerners. We don't realize it because we are Westerners, of course, but that's how we think. We tend to analyze things too much, perhaps. And we don't get the bigger picture. And so we didn't worry. I never worried about it when I read the Gospels. I never worried about Jewish culture or traditions and those sorts of things. But it makes a difference when you read it, whether or not you understand exactly what's going on. And those are the types of things that we're talking about in this class. Last week we talked about, for those of you who weren't here, we talked about Semeika. Remember Semeika? What does that mean? Oh, you've forgotten already. That means authority, doesn't it? That's an Aramaic term. And that's a problem as we read the Gospels because we get it translated into English from Greek. And it didn't happen in Greek. Well, some parts of it probably did. The people involved in Jesus' time in Jerusalem and in Israel knew some Greek because of the influence that had come from the conquest of Alexander the Great. And he had Hellenized a lot of that territory of the world and brought in the Greek language. But when the Israelites came back from Babylonian captivity, they spoke Aramaic, which was a cognate of Hebrew, similar to Hebrew, but different enough that it was a struggle to try to make sense out of the two languages. If you're talking in both languages, the terms may be different, although the structure of the language is the same. So we're trying. Semeika is an Aramaic term, doesn't appear in any of the Gospels because it's all in Greek. And they translated it and said authority. When in the Greek word, I don't remember what the Greek term is for authority. Some of you may know that. And so we don't get that term. But we talked last week about how they challenged him and said, where did you get your authority? And the authority was given to a teacher of the law when he had ripened by virtue of experience and old age to the point where he knew just about everything. Then he received authority from two other teachers who had authority. And so two rabbis who had authority would lay their hands on the candidate and he would become a rabbi with authority. And they approached Jesus and said, where'd you get your authority? Of course, they, as we mentioned, they may have expected that he would name two men who had given him authority and they would go clobber them because they didn't approve of Jesus' authority. But Jesus surprised them, didn't he? He came back and he said, well, I'll ask you a question. Where did John get his authority? Actually, the question he asked him was, did John's baptism come from heaven or from men? And of course, They couldn't answer that question. They didn't want to answer that question. It would get them into trouble. Either way they went. But in asking the question, Jesus answered the question. He got his authority from heaven, where John got his authority. And actually, he got his authority at the moment when John baptized him. And so you could actually point to two people who had authority who gave Jesus his authority. One would be John, and the other would be the Father, who spoke from heaven on that occasion. And the Holy Spirit, for good measure, who came down upon Jesus in the visible form of something that looked like a dove. So here that's what we talked about last week. Jesus had semeika. He had authority. And when he taught as one who had authority. That is, he was then able to say, in the law you heard it said, thou shalt not kill. But I say unto you, that's where the authority comes in. And the Sermon on the Mount is full of that, isn't it? Where he adds to what the law said. Instead of just, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not hate. And instead of, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not lust. So he was adding to it, and that was significant because that meant he had authority. Now, today, we're going to talk about something else. I never had linked all of these things together when I read the Gospels before. But as we looked at this story as it relates to the Jewish culture, there are some things in there that the Jews understood all along that we in the West just didn't bother to ask them about. And one of those today is fairly significant, the yoke of a rabbi. What is a yoke? We're not really an agrarian society anymore, but anybody that ever plowed with oxen would know what a yoke is. The yoke is the mechanism that held the two oxen together, wasn't it? And as they pulled a plow. A yoke is something that goes around the neck. And I have given you a handout today from the writings of Burton Kaufman, one of my heroes. And he gives you an example which is sort of typical of the way that verse of Scripture has been looked at, and we'll look at that in detail in a minute and see how classically it's been looked at by Western minds, but they miss the point because they don't understand the Jewish rabbi culture, and so we'll look at that in a minute. In keeping with the way we normally do things here, we're going to look at a verse of Scripture that has a bearing on today's lesson this time, but it also has a bearing on us as we teach somebody the gospel. These first verses that we look at, and this is a familiar verse in Deuteronomy. We made a song. We didn't make a song out of it. I don't guess Sonny made a song out of it either. Somebody else did, didn't they? And we sing that song, and so it's a familiar verse of Scripture. But let's stand and recite this together. It's important. Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Thank you. Please be seated. So when you teach someone about becoming a Christian, now Jesus carried this verse of Scripture from Deuteronomy into the new covenant, didn't he? And we'll see that today. When you teach someone to be a Christian, what does it mean to love God with all your heart? Have you already promised your spouse that you would love them, your husband or your wife, with all of your heart? Is there any left for God? Is that what it means? What does it mean? What are we talking about here? Does that mean you can't love anything else? I don't think so, because Jesus is going to say later on, also love your neighbors yourself. So there's got to be some room in your heart for love besides just God. So what does it mean to love him with all your heart? Put him first. And as far as gods go, there is one. That's what that verse said, wasn't it? The Lord is one. So he's first. He's the only. Lord alone is one of the translations of that particular Hebrew phrase. And so it's an exclusive love, isn't it? But it doesn't mean you can't love your spouse or your children or your neighbor. It means the love you have for God must be all-consuming as far as God's go. What about loving him with your, what's the second one? With your soul. How do you love God with your soul? With all your soul. What does that mean? What is your soul? How do we do that? Well, we'll just skip over that when we don't understand it, or do we work on that somehow? And what about the third one, with all your strength or with all your might? Those are really three different realms of your being, aren't they? Your heart in this context is largely your emotional attachment to God, and your soul is your spiritual attachment to him, and your strength is your physical attachment to him. That you have that doesn't leave much else of you, does it? Is that most of all that you are? You got any more parts? Well, there's another part, and when Jesus goes to quote this in one place in the New Testament, he adds a fourth, and it's in the song. What is it? Love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind. Yeah, Jesus added that because he knew what was coming, I'm sure, that in the Western world we place an awful lot of emphasis on analyzing things with our mind, and so he just added that one in one occasion. Love God with all your mind, all your logic. Okay, so that's quite a commitment. When you're talking to someone about becoming a Christian and explain this to them, it's not a hobby, is it? It's a way of life. And so it has to be a full, total commitment to God to love him the way this verse expresses it. And Jesus is going to talk about this verse. So, when you have a verse like this one, Jesus said was in a paragraph before this, I just put it in brackets there, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And so Jesus talks about his yoke. And it's called the Great Invitation. That's a very comforting phrase, a paragraph, isn't it? His talking to his disciples and those around him. All you who labor, and Burton in his commentary on this talks about the fact that everybody is heavily burdened at some point in their life, and they need Jesus to help them carry the burden. Some of the commentaries say, well, you're yoking yourself to Jesus so he can carry part of your load. You see, and all of those are good thoughts about this, but that doesn't explain what the yoke is in a technical way among the rabbis. And that's what we're going to explore, because as you see that, then some other verses of Scripture in the Gospels will have additional meaning than they do at the just on the surface. So, several things about his yoke revealed here. You take it upon you, and then what do? You learn something, right? That's what Jesus said. And my yoke is easy, and then there's a burden associated with the yoke. And the burden is light. That suggests that there are other rabbis who are teaching things that where the yoke isn't easy and the burden isn't light, right? They're overloading people with stuff. And that's one of the things that made Jesus pretty angry on a number of occasions, was the competition from other rabbis. So let's see what the yoke was. In Matthew 22, there is an event that's recorded also, I think, in Luke. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. That came incidentally in context, and we talk about context in here a lot. After the Sadducees had come at him with the puzzle of the woman who was married to seven different men, Remember that story? And Jesus said, you just don't understand about eternity. And in heaven, they're not all going to be, she's not going to be married to all seven of them. There is no marriage in heaven. So the Sadducees had asked that question. They were silenced. And the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, probably a teacher of the law, you see, tested him. Now, the word there is tested. This is a critical phrase in here. He's got a question that's a critical question. Which is the greatest commandment in the law? And that's asked, that comes up, I think, three times in the Gospels under various contexts. This occasion is repeated in Luke, but there's a couple of other occasions where the question comes up. And Jesus replied with the verse that we read at the start. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. He left out strength on that occasion, didn't he? This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. Why? What does he mean by they hang on these two? They get hung up on them, or they depend on them, I think is what he's talking about here. They depend on these commandments. If this isn't implemented, then the rest of the law doesn't mean anything. That's what he's saying. And all the things that the prophets said. Now these quotations are Deuteronomy 6:5, which we just read, and Leviticus 19 and 18. To find out what the yoke of a rabbi is, this is the question you ask him. Which is the most important commandment? Which is the greatest commandment? And that's what the Jewish rabbinical system understands this to mean. So they ask him, and hoping to trap him in some way, to get him to commit himself to a commandment. Now, what are they thinking about when they ask this question about the greatest commandment? They're really thinking about the Ten Commandments, aren't they? And most of them were experts in one or the other of those commandments. And some of those commandments lended themselves to public display. And we'll talk about that in a minute, because Jesus talks about it. All of the law and the prophets hang on this commandment. He picked one that they probably would not have chosen. They wouldn't have thought about it as a commandment, but it is. And actually, he's not the first of the rabbis to pick this phrase from Deuteronomy, this passage from Deuteronomy. The Jews tell us that Hillel, who was a famous rabbi from the 100 years before Christ, also used this as his yoke. So the yoke is the most important law, and the burden, the most important commandment, the burden is keeping that commandment. But it's that way because he's a rabbi and he's teaching a class, you see, of disciples. And so he's conveying to them his yoke, which is his commitment to a major theme, and the burden of the disciples is to understand that completely and to follow the teacher's lead. And so here's the burden. So the burden is keeping the commandments. Let's see how that plays out in some other rabbis, because you can see it once you understand what they're talking about here. It isn't explained anywhere, unfortunately. You just have to know these things. Okay. In the 23rd chapter of Matthew, Jesus starts a passage in which he complains about the teachers and the Pharisees and pronounces seven woes upon them. It's a famous passage. Woe unto you, Pharisees and teachers of the law, or scribes and Pharisees in the old King James Version. Now he said to the crowds, to his disciples, so he's teaching his disciples as he's talking to a larger crowd, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. What does that mean? Well, they're the religious authorities, aren't they, on the law, and they expound on the law endlessly. And so you must obey them and do everything they tell you, but do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. You ever heard that phrase? Is it important to practice what you preach? To show the example of, and of course Jesus does that all the way through his ministry. But some of these guys weren't doing it. They tie up heavy loads, the word there is burden, and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. So they say, this is a law and you must do this to their disciples, but they don't do it. See what Jesus is talking about here? So what is the yoke? Everything they do is done for men to see, he goes on. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels of their prayer shawls long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted in the marketplaces and to have men call them rabbi. What was their yoke? It's what they consider to be the most important commandments. Which commandments or commandment could they keep publicly to appear to be righteous? Remember the Sabbath, keep it holy. That's the big one. And they loved that one because it's something they could do to appear to be righteous and holy, you see. And it was something that was publicly displayed. And so they became experts in the law about the Sabbath. And so they studied that and they said, well, here are 10 suggestions to obey the Sabbath. And they gave a list of don't do these things. And maybe some do this and do this and do this. Like prepare your meals on Friday so that you don't have to work on Saturday preparing meals. Because the thing that really stuck in their craw was don't do any work on the Sabbath. So let's define work. Well, here are 50 definitions of work. And then as they studied it further, here's 150 definitions of work. And it gets longer and longer, the list. You see the burden that they're putting on people? And saying you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. And Jesus tackles them head on. And when you see him do that, you realize why they get so angry. Now, I lived in a world as a teacher in graduate school, as a professor, where I understood this business about defending your turf. You can kind of imagine already what I'm going to say. You become as a professor, you become a specialist in some small area. I mean, we got thousands of specialties in professional work. And it divides up into medicine and physics and chemistry, and then you get all of these little subdivisions and all of those, and you become an expert in, well, there was a joke about that says you learn more and more about less and less until you know everything about nothing. When you finally achieve your greatest endpoint there. So you specialize about some small area and you become the expert in that. And you glory in people coming to you for advice about that. And you teach it to your students. You devise classes to teach the things that you're expert in to the graduate students in the University of Texas where we were working at MD Anderson Hospital. And so now these men, these rabbis didn't get paid. It wasn't a salary job, although many of them may have had benefactors who supported them in their work. But the big deal was the glory. They loved to have men call them rabbi. They loved the honor, the chief seats at the banquets, all of the people bowing to them and honoring them for their great expertise in the law. Well, one of them would be the Sabbath. But let's name some more. Jesus goes on to talk about these. If you remember the context, he said they do something about the garden vegetables. What do they do? What do they do with those? They just cultivate them? they tithe them, you see. Okay, tithing, big deal. I mean, there's money involved in that, isn't it? And so you got to give God a tenth, not just your income. I suppose a tenth of all the dirt under your rug. I don't know. They went to the extreme, didn't they? If you pick a sack of leaves out of the herbs in your garden, and then you divide them up and you give God 10 and you get the rest of them. And so they go through this and make these rules. You see how they elaborate all of these things and become an expert in tithing. Can you think of any more? Do what? Ritual washing. Yeah. Your mother told you to wash your hands before you eat, right? Why? Because it's a ritual? No. Although it seemed like it when you're little, didn't it? It's clean your hands so you don't get germs down your gullet, right? So it's important because kids, their hands go everywhere, don't they? And so it's important. Maybe it's not all as important as we thought, because sometimes doctors are beginning to realize the kids may need to be exposed to some of these bugs so they build up some immunity to them. But anyway, any others that you think about? Yeah, food preparation. Yeah, there's all sorts of rules in the Old Testament about how you cook and what we call kosher preparation of the food, what the Jews called that. And so you have rabbis who were expert in that, and that was their yoke, that element of material that they had collected and elaborated upon and become expert in. And so, but let's look at particularly the one about the Sabbath. Now in Luke 6, this story is told, it's told in a couple of other places in the Gospels as well, the same story. On another Sabbath, so it's on the Sabbath, he went to the synagogue and was teaching. Is it okay to teach on the Sabbath? Does that work? It is work, I can tell you, it's work. And I think Ken would tell you it's work. He gets paid for it. So on the Sabbath you're working. But they didn't criticize him for teaching on the Sabbath. And as a matter of fact, you look at that and you say, well, what about the priests? They have to offer sacrifices every day. Is it work to kill a lamb and to skin him and to prepare him and put him on the altar and burn the sacrifice and collect the blood and all of the different rules that had to do with that? It was work. And Jesus pointed that out to them once. He says the priests don't profane the Sabbath by carrying out their religious activities. And so there's some things that can be done on the Sabbath. And Jesus was pointing that out, although these experts on the Sabbath didn't really want to believe that. And a man was there at the synagogue whose right hand was shriveled. Why would his hand be shriveled? Is that hereditary or a disease or something? Well, that's an interesting question. I don't really know how it happened to him. Sometimes an injury will cut off the nerve supply I have seen people whose hands get sucked back into their, have you seen that in people who are paralyzed? And so it's some sort of paralysis thing probably on his right hand. The Pharisees and teachers of the law, now these are the guys, some of the Pharisees are teachers of the law, were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. So they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. Well, is it okay to heal on the Sabbath? They didn't think so, okay? But Jesus knew what they were thinking and said to the man with the shriveled hand, get up and stand in front of everyone. So he got up and stood there. Then Jesus said to them, I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it? On another occasion, he asked a question, if your sheep or your ox falls into a ditch on the Sabbath day, you tell the poor beast struggling at the bottom of the ditch, I'm sorry, it's the Sabbath, you'll have to wait till tomorrow before I can pull you out. Can't even bring any water to you because hauling water to the ditch is against the Sabbath rules. Well, you know what? If one of these guys' ox fell in the ditch, he'd go haul it out on the Sabbath. He wouldn't like to do it publicly, but he probably would, or he may hire somebody else to do it for him. That's a more likely answer, wouldn't it? And so, obviously, on the Sabbath, to do good, to save life, is the correct answer to the question that the rabbi asks. And that's, you see, he answers the question by asking a question. He looked around at them all, and then he said to the man. Now, the story, this is in Luke, but the story over in Matthew, it says he got angry at them. Said to the man, stretch out your hand. And when he did so, his hand was completely restored. Just like that. But they were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. And in the Matthew account, it says they went out and plotted how to kill him. Now, why did that make them so angry? Well, of course, they couldn't heal the man with the shriveled hand, but I don't think jealousy was the point. He defied their authority. They would have said, you can't do this. And in fact, on another occasion, as you read the Gospels, you'll see these, where particularly the Sabbath business comes up again and again and again. He said, what was my point here? I've forgotten what it was I was looking at here. Challenged their authority. Oh, and they said, I know what I was going to say. They said, well, you can heal on other days. You don't have to heal on the Sabbath. But the occasion is there to do good. Do good on the Sabbath. And when you remember the case where the disciples were going through a grain field and they pulled a few heads of grain and munched on the kernels of wheat or barley in there while they were traveling, and they were accused of violating laws on the Sabbath, because that's harvesting the grain. When really harvesting is taking a sickle and cutting it and sheathing it and harvesting the whole crop. He said, well, that's not the case. He said, man was not made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man. What do you mean by that? It was for your benefit that God established the Sabbath. You're not supposed to suffer on the Sabbath because of rules and regulations. He really got after them on a number of occasions. And as you read the Sabbath business, the man healed by the pool of Bethesda, take up your bed and walk, or your mat and walk, and they got after him. The man who had been blind from birth, and John, who was healed when Jesus had him go wash, and it was on the Sabbath. You remember that? And there were all kinds of occasions like that, yes. Well, sure. Yeah, the rabbis got angry because they were being challenged. And it was an obvious public thing. That's the other thing. If you go to them in the private and discuss these matters, it probably make them mad, but on the other hand, it isn't public. That makes them furious. Okay, question over here. Yeah. Lord of the Sabbath, that's right. And, okay, Ken? That's right.
And he was, in essence, taking their control away.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute as we talk about application. Okay, go ahead. It's a good question. I know this. that the Orthodox Jews in New York, anyway, I don't know if it's true in Texas or not, they go in their house on Friday evening before sundown and switch on any lights they want on, because throwing a switch on a light switch is work, and they're forbidden to do that. So the light, their electric bill is 10% higher than everybody else's, because they burn all of their lights on Saturday all day through and just leave them on. Okay. Yeah.
But he also said it is not unlawful to do good.
I think that's right. I think they've finally concluded that you can do a Heimlich maneuver on somebody who's choking on the Sabbath. But they prepare food on the day before, so they'll have it. And they're all brands of Judaism, just like we see, unfortunately, Christianity. There are some liberals who don't pay any attention to any of this, and there are others that are Jews only in name and heritage, but not in religion. And so then there are gradations in between to the Orthodox. Yes.
Well, I will add that in his defense, I question, well, isn't this unduly burdensome?
Yeah.
He said, no, because it is a time and opportunity to show a complete devotion of our lives and our actions.
Yeah.
I know from working in Toronto, travel back and forth between New York and Toronto among the city Jews is very, very high. And they make a point of making sure that they book a flight on Friday to be home so they can be in their house before sundown on Friday night. But where the crisis comes in is the fact that flights are delayed in the wintertime up there. You always have flight delays. All of a sudden they're stuck in Toronto Airport and the sun is going down. There's little of a crisis.
Yeah, he says when the Jews that are traveling up north headed home and the airliners are delayed and they don't get home before dark, it's a big crisis in their life, because they need to be there before the sun goes down, if you could see the sun in the wintertime. Okay. And that's right. And you can see that there is some hierarchy among the laws when we get to talking about this. And so they were constantly discussing among themselves as to which was the greatest commandment. Now you see why that's a test when they come at Jesus with that question, which is the greatest, which is the most important commandment, because there is some overlap between them. Well, let's look at one other example. Some who were confident in their own righteousness and looked down on everybody else. Jesus told this very familiar parable about the two men who went to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself. Avoid this when you pray, okay? This is not a good example. God, I thank you that I'm not like all other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. So there's another area, fasting. And they challenged Jesus about fasting, didn't they? Your disciples don't fast. John's disciples fasted. And the Pharisees' disciples fast. Why didn't Jesus' disciples fast? And he had an answer for them. And you can go check that out. But that was an area, fasting and praying. These were all areas where there were specialties among the rabbis. All right. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven. He beat on his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And his prayer, of course, was heard. This man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. He who humbles himself will be exalted. And so there, as you read the Gospels, see this undercurrent of conflict between Jesus and his yoke, which was to love God and what? Love your neighbor. Yeah. And that takes care of the rest of it. If you love your neighbor, you're going to murder him. You're going to have adultery and enter into your life. You're going to covet the things that he has. You're going to do the terrible things? How about honoring your father and mother? That's another of the commandments. And loving God takes care of the first half of the commandments, doesn't it? So all of the rest of them are included in this, and so he picks a rather obscure set of verses as far as they're concerned, and says this is bigger than all the rest of it, and this should govern your life completely. Love God, and we talked about the emphasis on the heart, and it's not just emotion. The heart wasn't used that way. In some cases, it does mean emotion, but out of the heart comes all of these evil things that people speak, he talked on one occasion. And you can't have, I think it was James said, you can't have salt water and fresh water flowing out of the same fountain kind of a situation. So keeping your heart pure was a really critical feature of Jesus' yoke. And the burden, why is the burden easy? It's what? It can be kept. Yeah, you can love people. You have to work at it, and you have to get rid of some of your prejudices and look at people for who they really are and what they represent and see the good in people. And certainly loving God is easy. We love Him because He first loved us. And it doesn't have all of the 101 different ways to do this. That's right. Okay, question here. Yeah. That clapping, sure. Yeah. No, I don't think we do. I don't think we should. Yeah, we have to be careful about that, don't we? I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. We've got to be careful not to make a bunch of extra rules. Now, the elders have responsibility for the worship services and can do some things that they think are expedient if the congregation is agreeable to it. But we don't want to make a bunch of rules and say these are life and death situations. That's certainly not the case. Now, next week, we're going to look at the selection of the apostles. There's some real surprises in that story. And I hope to see you all next week. Thank you for your participation today. If you need a back issue of any of the